This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the world has changed at least a little bit over the past 2 weeks. In Canada, a meeting of the G7 countries failed to achieve a consensus between the U.S., Western Europe, and Japan on trade or on relations with Russia. But just a few days later, President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un reached the beginnings of an agreement on establishing peace on the Korean Peninsula after nearly 70 years of hair-trigger hostilities and threats of nuclear confrontation. We'll talk with Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Montero, Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace, and Omali Yeshitela of the Black is Back Coalition.
But first, we talked with David Swanson, the veteran anti-war activist and director of World Beyond War. The Democratic Party used to be thought of as at least somewhat less warlike than the Republicans, but most Democrats are opposed to Donald Trump making peace with North Korea. David Swanson says,
"It's really disgusting to see Democratic Congress members and senators and media pundits and activists condemning an obvious step toward peace with all its imperfections. It's not a step toward war, it's a step toward peace, and introducing legislation to prevent the removal of any U.S. troop from South Korea. And Senator Tammy Duckworth speaking about Trump daring to take it out on the troops so that bringing troops home from an imperial outpost counts as, you know, almost an attack on those troops." And I think Congressman Ro Khanna was correct when he said that if his colleagues saw the same exact thing happen under President Barack Obama, they would be cheering 100%, and instead they're condemning. And I can sort of understand that when you watch Donald Trump show this ridiculous propaganda video and then talk with all of his bragging and falsehoods and ridiculous, embarrassing manners of speech, that you don't want to, you know, identify with that person and cheer for that person. Well, identify with the cause of peace. This was a step toward peace, stating that the United States would end the war rehearsals, the so-called war games in South Korea. Now, the Pentagon is already openly saying it's not going to do that completely. And I think that's where we should be putting our pressure and our focus, is demanding that the Pentagon, in fact, end all war games in Korea. But to look at that and say, oh, well, this was a bad deal because the evil Kim got something, the Koreans got something, and the Americans didn't, has this sort of rivalry, who got what out of a trade, works against peace. If your cause is peace, then this was a step in the right direction, regardless of your silly partisan identity.
Well, you know, some people may interpret the Democrats' reaction in terms of partisan politics, but when we hear Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader, complain that Trump elevated North Korea to an equal of the United States, well, I think we're hearing an imperial mentality and a racist mentality. How dare these North Koreans be elevated to the status of the United States?
And a very hypocritical and dishonest mentality at that. The United States government currently allows U.S. weapons sales and in several cases gives free U.S. weapons to 73% of the dictatorships as identified by the U.S. government as dictatorships on the planet. And most of them, the vast majority of them, the U.S. military provides training in militarism to these dictatorships. So North Korea is an exception in being merely met with and talked with. The rule, the general rule for brutal dictatorships around the globe is for the United States to not just meet and talk with them, but provide support and weaponry and training. I mean, how many weeks is it since Saudi royalty was in Washington, D.C.? What kind of memory do these people have who are outraged that the United States, as if this was some kind of elevation, would elevate a dictator by speaking with him? It's absurd.
Well, of course, these are dictatorships that support corporate and capital penetration of their own countries and everybody else's.
They are. And there have always been double standards and hypocrisy. And it is certainly the case that there are flaws that can be condemned in any government, including that of North Korea. But do you talk with the government of North Korea, or do you threaten to bomb it, or do you sanction it and cause more deaths by starvation? You know, sanctioning governments leads them toward the extreme right. It doesn't move them toward democracy or human rights or any of the things we hear about in the rhetoric. Threatening to bomb them has the exact same effect. So there's an incredible gap between the stated intentions and the chosen means of action. If the United States, regardless of party or personality, wanted to move Korea, including North Korea, in the direction of peace and the rule of law and transparency and accountability, I mean, the very first thing it would do would be to get the heck out and allow the Koreans to find their own way to peace and possibly reunification. Short of that, the United States needs to take part in negotiations that allow the war to finally be ended. And the key here is South Korea and the people of South Korea, who, with help from people in the United States and around the globe, have overthrown one government, put in another, compelled it to work for peace, have a leader now in South Korea who, for the first time in decades, is willing to stand up to the U.S. government to some degree. And they are going to move peace forward. And if the Democrats in Washington or the Republicans or some combination try to block that for the good of the world and possibly for the survival of the world, we have to do everything we can to prevent them.
That was David Swanson of World Beyond War speaking from Washington.
In Philadelphia, Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Montiero sees the Korea talks as a pivotal point in history.
First of all, on the side of Trump, who was both rational and irrational at the same time. Trump, I believe, crystallizes what has been inevitable for at least a decade and a half, if not more, that of the processes of imperial retreat, the attempt to be the single superpower, the military hegemon in the world, was bankrupting the U.S. And this is obviously clearly reflected in the collapse of the U.S. infrastructure, by which I include not just bridges and roads and buildings, but also the ruin of the American people through lack of health care, through lack of education, through lack of the possibility of a decent life. So the American people as a whole, including the African American people, had become extremely disenchanted with the direction of the U.S. empire and of the U.S. ruling elite. And in a lot of ways, as we've discussed before, it is that discontent that led to the 2016 victory of Donald Trump. There's no other way to look at it. So there is that tendency, that process of imperial retreat, unacknowledged in the media, unacknowledged by most politicians who want us to believe that the United States is still the great superpower. But imperial retreat was inevitable, and a regroupment and a reorientation of the relationships of the United States, not just to the world in general, but really to its principal allies like the European Union. But that having been said, the brilliance of the leadership of North Korea was to seize the moment. Now, of course, that capacity to seize the moment required that the North Korean state arrive at a new level of military and technological capacity to defend the state, the Korean state, and hence the Korean nation, which they have. And that was spectacular. It was a spectacular political, technological, military feat to have developed the missiles and the hydrogen explosive capacities that they have, in spite of every attempt by the United States to intimidate them, to use cyber warfare, to undermine their tests and so on. They reached that level. And once that had been reached, then they were able to negotiate with, first of all, the Asian or Northeast Asian nations, in particular, China and South Korea, and to negotiate not from a position of strength, but from a position of equality. And thence the fact that the president of South Korea was a mediator, a go-between to make possible what the leadership of North Korea proposed, a meeting with the president of the United States and the beginning of processes towards a detente, an end to the Korean War, the reunification in one another form of North and South Korea, and the withdrawal of U.S. military forces. I think, and this is a spectacular achievement, all of those things are pretty close to being realized. If you read the Singapore Declaration or document, it in effect says that North Korea and the United States want relationships of what used to be called peaceful coexistence. Trump said that he is for the end of these military exercises, which he said are and have been provocative, and ultimately the withdrawal of the 30,000 U.S. troops, and of course all of these weapon systems and aircraft carriers and so on from the waters around the Korean Peninsula and in South Korea. I would finally say that what we have seen is the emergence on the world scene of a new type of leadership coming out of North Korea, a small nation, and most of the nations of the world are relatively small in terms of population, a small nation, a united people, a committed leadership, were able to stand up for its right to self-determination in the face of threats and belligerency coming from the most powerful military empire in human history.
You described the South Korean president as a mediator, but I think maybe he was much more of an initiator. The two Korean leaders met certainly before the meeting with Trump and continued their dialogue even in the face of what seemed to be real U.S. opposition to them getting together. Mm-hmm. After all, that is the whole purpose, isn't it? To divide the Koreans.
Right. Yes, but I would still stick to my characterization. The principal agent of these processes is the North Korean leadership. If you recall, it was the North Korean government and Kim Jong-un that first floated the idea of North Korea being a part of the Olympics in South Korea. And from there, a number of other moves followed, including the fact that the sister and I think the president of North Korea attended the Olympics, and then other negotiations with the government of South Korea leading to, for the first time, a leader and a president of North Korea crossing the border into South Korea, and this great celebration of the possibility of reuniting the Korean Peninsula. I mean, this was so spectacular that 85% of the South Koreans look upon Kim Jong-un positively. So it's with that, and I agree with you, that the initiating of these processes began between the Koreans. And it is that which wisely Trump, if not his administration, realized that something new was happening, that inevitably the Korean people, North and South, would reject the whole scheme of U.S. military occupation and these exercises. I think that's what happened. And I think the North Korean leadership is principally the major factor in all of this.
And because this is in large part an agreement between Koreans, the development of these relationships, North and South, is something that the United States cannot effectively prohibit or inhibit.
That's right. And see, the other thing about it is that once the Koreans had reached what is in effect a detente and an agreement to end the Korean War and to come to some principles of unity, then the government in China responds to this, invites Kim Jong-un twice to Beijing for talks, which are friendly, which establish that if a detente is reached between the Koreans and then the United States, that the Chinese government would withdraw from the sanctions regime against North Korea. And then later, the foreign minister of Russia shows up in North Korea for talks with the leadership there, and then invites Kim Jong-un for a state visit to Russia. And then on top of that, the president of Syria, Assad, says that he intends to make a state visit to North Korea. I mean, what we are seeing is an unleashing of processes of peace and self-determination, the likes of which we have not seen in over 25 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I would predict that all roads from Africa and Asia and maybe even Europe now lead, and also South America, now lead to North Korea. I think the leadership there will be a model for many nations in the world and demonstrates how both to pursue socialist construction, to consolidate state power, and at the same time to develop the technology necessary to defend the state.
Russia and China did participate in sanctions against North Korea. Russia and China have participated in sanctions against Iran, even though Iran is now or will soon be a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement. And even though these sanctioning parties have been sanctioning Russia, are we going to soon see an end to Russia and China's cooperation with these sanctioning regimes?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think in terms of the sanctioning regimes against Iran and North Korea, they're done. And the United States, if it continues sanctions or new sanctions, as Trump is talking about against Iran, they will be isolated. And certainly the world, including the Trump administration, has stated that they are prepared to withdraw from the sanctions regime against North Korea. But I think it raises still some questions about how Russia and especially China operated over the last 35 years on the world stage. It was like they were allowed to come into the World Trade Organization, which is this global finance capital run organization with rules of operation that favor multinational corporations and banks and so on. Once they were in there, then they began to play by the rules of the West, including in the UN Security Council, to position themselves against nations who develop weapons merely to defend themselves. And so the Russians and the Chinese, and especially the Chinese, were playing this 19th century and 20th century great power game, that what was in the interest of China would be pursued. And there was no sense of international solidarity. That is, of course, not new in China. Even after the revolution, they were profoundly nationalistic and Chinese-centric. And so they remained so. Hopefully, there might be some changes. The Russians, of course, sanctions against North Korea for its developing nuclear weapons, but at the same time, inviting Netanyahu as a state visitor on the National Day celebrating the end of World War II. Friendship with Israel, but in this period that we're talking about, hostility in favor of Western interests against North Korea and Iran. I think that might be ending. It does not solve all the problems because the leaderships in Russia and China are divided on any number of issues, including their role in the world, how, if at all, they will fight for world peace. But more than that, will China eventually return to the path of socialist construction? And will Russia adopt policies that do not favor oligarchs and rich people and billionaires in Russia, but are more predisposed to a working class, even a social democratic policy that will uplift the living standards of their own people?
Certainly half the Republicans don't sincerely support this peace initiative, and the Democrats are outright hostile. Is there only Trump standing behind this on the U.S. scene?
No, no. Again, I go back to the inevitability of imperialist retreat. U.S. imperialism had overreached and was bankrupting itself and the nation to support its military empire. Retreat was inevitable. They weren't going to announce it and say, oh, we're in imperial retreat. But if you look at much that's going on in the world, one sees this retreat. Now, TPP, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which comes out of the Obama administration, to me, represented in a very ironic way the sense that the military empire had to retreat and take second or backseat to new economic relationships in East Asia. But, you know, again, and here we're just speculating, I think we're looking at what was inevitable for Republicans and Democrats. The conflict was over how to do it, when to do it, and so on. Of course, you get hardliners that say we never can retreat. And then you get people who are hardliners in public, but in private recognize that the United States' role in the world had to change, or else both parties would face on a grander scale what happened in 2016, which again was the result of a legitimation crisis that masses of people have turned against the political establishment, literally the regime itself. And without a new kind of, you could call it a new deal, a social democratic set of policies to do something for the increasingly impoverished American population. And what I saw as very important in 2016, and it's not just a single line, it's contradictory, is that a great part of, if not the majority, of white Americans are distancing themselves from the neoliberal regime, which, and the policies which have impoverished them.
That was Dr. Anthony Monteiro speaking from Philadelphia.
One would think that anyone that is truly interested in avoiding nuclear war would have had a positive response to the agreement between Trump and North Korea. We spoke with Ajamu Baraka, the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace.
I would agree with that. And you would think that that would be the rational response from most people who are concerned about peace, who would like to avoid conflict. But interesting enough, that doesn't seem to be the case. In particular, among those forces that are part of and aligned with the Democratic Party, they seem to believe that the Singapore summit was, in fact, a disaster. They suggest that the U.S., which is, in fact, the occupying power in South Korea, gave up too much because they decided that they were going to suspend these provocative military maneuvers that they engage in twice a year. Forgetting, I guess, that the North Koreans had just a month or so ago unilaterally decided that they're going to suspend their ballistic missile testing and their nuclear testing, and were waiting for a response from the U.S. Well, the response from the U.S. was to, in fact, proceed forward with their planned military maneuvers. That is a decision that almost scuttled the Singapore summit. So the response coming out of the summit from the Trump administration to suspend, and they use that term very, I think, intentional, to suspend the maneuvers, the next one's coming up in a few months, was in fact the proper response to the unilateral decision made by the North Koreans. But for the Democrats, operating from this mangled white supremacist consciousness and worldview, felt like that was too much to give the natives.
Essentially, what happened in Singapore is a great victory, a real step forward historically for the Korean people. They're the ones who share a common history and peninsula. They're the ones who've been separated ever since World War II. They're the ones who have lost millions in conflicts. They're the ones who the U.S. has bombed, North and South.
And they're the ones that are the most enthusiastic about the possibility of a final resolution of the Korean War and the potential for peace. But these European colonialists don't really care about the Korean people. Because look, Glenn, the situation with North Korea was never really about just North Korea. The conflict, the ongoing conflict and tensions between the U.S. and North Korea was part of a broader strategic objective. And that is to maintain the tensions in order to provide justifications for the continuation of U.S. forces in South Korea. But the focus wasn't on the North. The focus is on China. So this has been part of their strategic objective. It serves a number of objectives. It allows for them to remain in South Korea. It continues with the North Koreans being framed as this essential evil element that also justifies the continuation, or one of the arguments for the continuation of the obscene military budget, which is a transfer from the public pockets straight into the pockets of the military-industrial complex. So, you know, this situation with North Korea is a situation in which there's conflict now internally among the ruling elites, who some are concerned about this move toward peace. We saw the response the other day from the stock market that some of the major military corporations lost a significant value in their stock as a consequence of this possible breakthrough for peace. So, you know, when you look at the material reality, when you look at follow the money, if you will, you see that the North Korean situation is much more complicated than might appear on the surface.
Yes, peace seems to be bad for business, and Wall Street knows it.
You know, Glenn, and this has been the case with North Korea from, you mentioned, ever since the end of the Second Imperialist War, the Second World War. And it's important for people to recognize and to be reminded that, like most of the post-war conflicts, the leading edge, the main protagonist, if you will, in the U.S. side were the Democrats. Harry Truman, his administration, concluded that they were concerned about the possibility of a post-war downturn in the U.S. economy. They wanted to maintain, expand military expenditures, but they needed proper justifications. The Korean War served that purpose quite nicely. The Truman administration expanded the military budget threefold. They put in place the process of connecting up various U.S. bases in the Pacific area. They became the model for the global network of U.S. bases. So the Korean situation, as part of the broader sort of strategic alignment of U.S. imperialism, has played a very central role in that broader imperialist mission. So these are the kinds of things we have to take into account when we attempt to try to deconstruct what is happening with that issue. Again, you know, you have some forces that would like to see a resolution of the situation with North Korea. You have some very powerful forces, on the other hand, that are willing to support Trump's completed pivot to Asia and recognize that part of that pivot to Asia means maintaining a fairly significant physical presence of U.S. troops in Korea.
And this democratic reaction to what happened in Singapore, almost entirely negative, isn't then just a partisan reaction, but part of the historical stance of the Democratic Party.
Exactly. And I think what has been revealed by the Democrats is that they are, in fact, a party of war. They have been bought and paid for by elements of the military-industrial complex, just like how people will stereotype Republican politicians. There's no real fundamental difference between those two parties when it comes to the corruption of the political process by these powerful forces aligned with the military-industrial complex. So this is more than just a partisan stance. While it is a partisan stance in the sense that they think that they can advance some kind of political objectives by opposing Trump and pretending to be the more responsible party, but it's a very dangerous and cynical game that they're playing in trying to outright Donald Trump. It is playing right into the kind of conservatism that we have seen develop over the last 9 years, beginning with the ascendancy of Barack Obama, that shifted public opinion among liberals, among black folks, decidedly toward the right. So this is going back now, helping to sort of buttress or prop up that kind of conservatism and ideological conformism with the U.S. state and the oligarchy that we saw developing in a real way under the Obama administration. So it is a dangerous game that they are, in fact, playing, and it is undermining any ability on their part to really differentiate themselves from the Republicans. And by not being able to do that, they are playing right into the hands of the Republicans, not only for 2018, but also for 2020.
And you were speaking of democratic wars, which brings up the war in Yemen, which was Barack Obama's war as well as Saudi Arabia's war, and now Donald Trump's war.
Exactly. And we know that right now, as we speak, there is an impending attack by the Saudis on the main port there in Yemen, where vital humanitarian goods are coming into the country to provide basic support for the Yemenese people, a people where almost 80% of the populations are now dependent on the importation of food and fuel from the outside. The Saudis, with the clear support, logistical support from the U.S., are getting ready to engage in what, in fact, will be a genocidal attack if they're able to shut down that port. So we see that the war agenda continues, not only in Yemen, but throughout the so-called Middle East. We see the collaboration between the two parties as we are temporarily diverted with the situation with North Korea. We have to remind ourselves and remind folks who listen to this program and read Barr and other publications that the Democrats are involved now in providing more space for the executive to engage in war. There's a joint resolution to expand the authorization to use military force, co-sponsored by Tim Kaine and Bob Corker from Tennessee on the Republican side, Tim Kaine from Democrats, to give the executive almost unlimited power to deploy U.S. military assets around the world. This is a departure, and more than just an expansion, but really a departure from the relatively limited authorization to use military force in 2011. So we see another example of this collaboration between the two parties. But interestingly enough, while they are willing to give the executive that kind of power to wage unlimited war, Lindsey Graham and Senate Democratic leaders believe that they have to tie the hands of the executive when it comes to troops being withdrawn from South Korea. They are now looking at a resolution introduced by two Democrats to undermine the ability of the Trump administration to take troops out of South Korea. So again, the agenda is quite clear in terms of both parties being committed to full spectrum dominance and both parties being parties committed to war.
Bernie Sanders is clearly going to be a candidate in 2020. Any evidence from what you see that he'll be different on the foreign policy front?
Not at this point. He has made slight alterations in his pro-war and pro-imperialist policies, but he just said a few days ago, or last Sunday, I think it was, that he believes that the drone campaign and using drones is an effective weapon for U.S. policy, notwithstanding the fact that it is illegal, but he's prepared to use drones to advance U.S. interests in the so-called war on terror. We don't see any clear indication he's willing to break from the Democrats when it comes to these issues around North Korea. We know that he's taken a backward position on the destabilization campaign in Venezuela. So there's no separation between those two parties and even Bernie Sanders. And that's why this issue of war and peace is going to be a serious issue, because I think more and more people, more and more working class and poor people are beginning to recognize that they are being used as cannon fodder, or potentially will be used again as cannon fodder to advance the interests of the 1%. And more people are beginning to wake up to that reality. So if there's no alternative between those two war parties, then there may be an opportunity for people to begin to look at other parties that will stand for clear opposition against war and against wasting the resources of the U.S. state and the precious lives of people in this country to advance the interests of the capitalist oligarchy.
And to return to Yemen, many of our listeners may not realize that it is the United States that refuels the Saudi Arabian airplanes that bomb Yemen daily, that U.S. AWACS pick out the targets for those bombers, that U.S. ships are part of the blockade of Yemen that keeps out food and fuel, that U.S. weapons are being used by the Saudi Arabians, and that U.S. special forces are, in fact, on the ground fighting in Yemen.
Exactly. And that information has to be revealed and said over and over again, especially when you see this simplistic propaganda being pushed around. Why would the Trump administration sit down with this murderous dictator, pretending like there is some kind of fundamental difference between some of the elements that the U.S. is in bed with, like the Saudi Arabian government, like the apartheid regime in Israel? So this phony kind of moralism has to be met with the reality of what is in play with U.S. policy, and to help people to move away from these kinds of phony appeals to morality and look at the concrete material interests that are in play, and to recognize that those material interests that are being advanced are not the interests of the people, but in fact are the interests of the 1%, the interests of the transnational ruling class, still primarily centered and led by forces in the U.S.
We've been talking about the Democrats in general, but not the Black Democrats on the Hill, the Congressional Black Caucus. Where do they stand, or do they stand at all?
Well, you know, Glenn, at one point, the Congressional Black Caucus used to be referred to as the conscience of the House and the conscience of U.S. politics. But we have seen over the last few decades that that consciousness has basically not been there. We don't see any definitive positions being taken in opposition to the warmongering of the Democrats. And so in this case with North Korea, we also are not seeing any clear definitive statements being made that are not in alignment with the statements from the Democratic leadership. So we are calling, that is those of us who are part of the Black Alliance for Peace, we are calling for the members of the Congressional Black Caucus to indicate where they stand on these questions. Do they support peace, or are they willing to stand with their Democratic colleagues and standing with maintaining an escalation of tensions between the U.S. and North Korea? So we say, where are the Democrats? We call on the leadership of all of these moral forces to take a stance and to specifically indicate where you stand on these issues of war and peace.
I think it's been several decades since the Congressional Black Caucus came out with a common position on any issue of international affairs.
Exactly. And they've been allowed to get away with that because of the lack of accountability with many of these individuals who are incumbents, who have not had serious challenges in their districts. We need to, as we build an anti-war movement, as more and more people begin to recognize that the Democrats are no more different than Republicans when it comes to these issues of war and peace, I think some of those Democrats who are in these safe seats, they need to, I think, feel the consequences of their class collaboration with the 1%. We see that happening in the Republican side, but very little that is happening on the Democrat side. We need accountability. Those folks have to be called out, and we intend, in fact, to do that.
That was Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace.
Before President Trump had his successful meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore, he traveled to Canada to meet with leaders of the United States, European, Canadian, and Japanese allies. Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, has been closely following the unfolding crisis in U.S. relations with its allies. Trump's Canada trip was anything but triumphant.
It did not go well, and in many ways, what went down in Canada is related to what happened in Singapore as well, because what we've been watching for a while now is a real assault on a particular arrangement of imperialists, and that got organized after the Second Imperialist World War into what has been called the Atlanticist Bloc, that saw the emergence of NATO, the IMF, the World Bank, the United Nations, and a lot of other institutional mechanisms through which three things were to occur. One, containing Soviet Russia. Two, making it difficult for Germany to seek to dominate the world again and through war, particularly in Europe. And three, to have peaceful mechanisms through which the rest of the world could be controlled by white power. So that's what we've been watching. And that's why it's been difficult in many instances for people to understand the Trump phenomena and why Trump sounds to so many people as crazy, irrational, etc., because the way people have been taught to understand the world over the last period is through the viewpoint, the lenses of the Atlanticists. And that is through media and a host of other kind of entities that have succeeded in defining the world for the majority of the people. And so we've seen this thing fraying for a while, this arrangement. And the critical thing that happened, of course, was the collapse of the Soviet Union, which removed, in many ways, the logic for the existence of the Atlanticists, which came into existence in part to contain the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was no longer a threat, and that relieved in Europe some of the pressures to bind themselves to the United States, because there was no assumption that anybody had to be protected from Russia anymore, and in some instances opened the door for potential relationships between particular European states and Russia. And so it was possible to conceive of new kinds of arrangements. And much of what was happening, too, was that changes in the world you saw the escalation of struggles of peoples who were fighting to get their own resources. The imperialist pie begins to shrink. You begin to have a more every white man for himself kind of politics being expressed, where increasingly the unity of the Atlanticist bloc was being challenged. So now this great, magnificent effort that began with Richard Milhouse Nixon, one of the supreme reactionaries of the world, with the move to China, the dollar signs in the eyes of capitalists everywhere. I remember they used to say, with a billion Chinese, if we just sold just a yard of fabric to every Chinese, what that was going to mean in terms of profit. And what it did mean was that Lenin's maxim that the capitalist would sell you the rope to hang himself with was something that was about to go into play, because they went into China with the assumption that they were just dealing with some dumb yellow people. Remember, you don't have a Chinaman's chance. And they went into China and they got gobbled up. And China has exploded. There's a fast-growing economy that's actually began to intrude upon some of the spaces that have been occupied by powerful forces like the United States and others that were part of the Atlanticist operation. So a lot of stuff was in play now, and we saw increasing limitations being placed on the power of imperialism, and certainly U.S. imperialism, because even if it was not said, people recognized that the U.S. was a big hegemon that led the Atlanticist group. And now the U.S. is trying to find a way to penetrate China, as are other forces. Now the U.S. having to find a way to contain China. So I'm saying that there's a fraying of much of the arrangements that had been established under the Atlanticist project. And we look at what just happened in Canada, where Trump walks out on the group, refuses to sign the agreement. But again, it was an Atlanticist bloc already fraying. You have England that's responsible for Brexit. You have Italy. That's where we see an anti-EU force just been elected, reactionary force in Italy. Spain is fracturing in terms of even movements that where they had to lock up leaders of movements who were talking about splitting from Spain and Catalan. So it's a whole new day. China challenging all of the imperialist forces in Africa, fastest growing economy there. So there's a huge movement of political and economic forces, and much of what we see happening is reflecting that movement. And that's what happened again with the G7 group, and Trump walks out, and the trade wars, then this is trade arrangements that established under the arrangements that were forged through the Atlanticist bloc. All of that stuff is up for grabs now. It's up in the air. And there's movement now by different forces, and some forces who are close to Trump, and I cannot say who they are. Some of them are new and on the make now, hungry for a place at the trough that they didn't have before with the old arrangement that existed. So what we see is internecine struggle that's happening within the dominant capitalist bloc on both sides of the Atlantic.
Trump said a lot of things in Canada. Among them, he charged the Europeans with kicking Russia out of what was once the G8. He said, "You guys kicked Russia out." Well, actually, Obama kicked Russia out.
Yeah. And this, too, I think is a part of the whole thing. We got to remember, and for a time, Soviet Russia was a kind of counterbalance to U.S. And for a while, there was what existed, what many people refer to as a bipolar, and if you include China at the time, a tripolar kind of world. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, then it was clear. And we saw Clinton and others who just knew that now capitalist America was going to dominate the world, and they made some real inroads on influence and spheres of Russian interest, and even had some Russian leaders functioning as toadies for a while. Until what we see with the arrival of Putin, which saw Russia develop some spine in its own interest and had decided that it would not submit simply to every place that the United States wanted it to go to, which made it a problem, which is responsible at this time for Russia being inexplicably characterized by most of the news pundits today as our quote-unquote adversary. And I don't know what that means. I don't know how Russia got to be an adversary, except that it is looking out for its own national interests as it sees them. And sometimes these interests intrude on the ability of U.S. capital in particular to have its own way. So now, for whatever reason, this whole new arrangement, of course, Russia is aligned with China in terms of the Silk Road project, where China is organizing blocks of capital in Asia, and almost everybody in Asia, with the exception of Australia and Indonesia and South Korea, are part of it, and only they not a part of it because the United States threatened them with punitive action should they become a part of it. So there's a whole new arrangement, economic arrangements happening in the world. Hugo Chavez was participating in trying to make some stuff happen, and even Muammar Gaddafi was trying to move from the dominance of U.S. currency. So all of this is movement that challenges the old arrangements. And I think that taken together, they mean a lot. And the world has changed. And Trump is a clear evidence of some change. And when I say it's changed in this instance, I mean that the old arrangements among the imperialist powers themselves, that arrangement has been under a major assault. And Trump is one of the latest manifestations of that. And so there's a lot of stuff in play. There's a lot of flux that's happening in the world, people and countries scrambling to, in their own interest, looking at new relationships. And I've read that even international intelligence organizations like MI6, the CIA of England, has participated in trying to undermine Trump because of what it meant in terms of the whole Atlanticist bloc. And so it's military, as we know, with NATO and other entities like that, and we've seen that at play. It's political in addition to that with the United Nations and how it has been a toady for a while now for U.S. Imperialism. And intelligence organizations from the Atlanticist Project have been involved in this as well. So I've read, as I said, that England, the MI6 from England, actually played a role in exposing Trump's Russia connection as a means of undermining this new trajectory that Trump has been trying to promote even before he got elected, with uniting with Russia. And then he comes to G7, and this becomes also a part of a struggle, but it's bigger than simply a political outburst or political struggle. There are also new economic arrangements that are at play here, and what that means in terms of investments and economic relationships with powerful forces in Russia and in the United States and other places.
Yes, when Vladimir Putin was asked whether he'd be amenable to rejoining the G8, he said he wasn't interested because otherwise engaged, which meant, of course, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is led by China, which was also holding a meeting about the same time that Europe and the U.S. and Japan were in Canada. And that meeting went swimmingly, as the British might say. The Chinese leader pointed out that the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement contains nations whose economies about match those of the G7 countries, but include about half of the world's population.
Exactly. So there's a major shift that's happening here. And in many ways, like I said, Trump is a manifestation of it. It was something that was anticipated. It was something that's been seen. In part, that's what Obama's Asian pivot reflected that. And this was influenced by people like Brzezinski, who had talked about imperialism had run into the age of empires over, according to how he put it in his advice to the leaders of the imperialists. And he was particularly, specifically when he was dealing with Obama, and that learning how for the U.S. is never going to be able to lead in the same old way, and that it had to discover how to sort of lead from behind, that it's going to have to lead, but it can't do it in the same old way. But the problem has been that you can't tell an imperialist state that it can't lead in the way it has always done. You've got a state apparatus that people are referring to as the deep state and things like that, intent on doing things the way they've always done it, intent on dominating the whole world. And so the political explanations don't necessarily easily make their way into the political arena. So as much as Obama would have liked to have done things differently with China and Russia, it was impossible because what the U.S. does, it says, this is a new arrangement. This is how we're going to do things now. And this is what you're going to do, Russia. And this is what you're going to do, China. And the Chinese and Russians could not allow themselves to be utilized in that fashion. They saw and realized they had their own interests, and they were willing to go toe-to-toe with the United States in the discussion and debate in terms of how the world was going to be operated, and the U.S. cannot enter into a relationship equally like that, which is one of the reasons why this thing with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is such an issue for a lot of people, because now you have the United States having to treat them yellow people who have been characterized in such foul ways as colonized people traditionally are. Now you got to act like they're equal. Now you got to act like this guy can sit down at the table, and now you're conferring legitimacy upon him by sitting down. And so this was something that was unthinkable, but they're there now, and they're there because there's something that's changing under their own feet. Even if some of their best spokesperson don't get it or refuse to get it or trying to hold back the future, it's not going to work. It's a whole new world that we face now. And of course, an issue for us is how to take advantage of this motion, this flux that exists today in all of these relationships and arrangements that's prevailed for the longest period, and how do black people, Africans, assert our interests and build the kind of political organization and strategies that will advance our cause, notwithstanding what direction Trump and the Koreans or anybody else appear to be moving.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.